Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Hi there, this is Jeremy Scheinwald. Welcome to another episode of Smart People Should Build Things, the VFA podcast. I'm also an entrepreneur, founder of the Mission Driven Group, who truly enjoys talking about entrepreneurship. Thus far, this podcast has been a labor of love for me. I'm lucky to have David Kidder on the podcast today, a serial entrepreneur who's done a lot of research into entrepreneurship himself. David is most recently the co-founder of Bionic. It's in stealth form, so I'll let you listen to David talk about it. I say most recently because he's served as the co-founder and CEO of Clickable, an online advertising software as a service firm acquired by Syncaps, SmartRay Network, a mobile advertising pioneer acquired by LifeMinders, and NetX, a web authoring platform acquired by TargetVision. David's an active angel investor through his fund, Alt Option Return, with investments including Artsy, Tapad, Milewise, which was acquired by Yahoo, Payoff, How About We, and more. In addition to starting and investing in this myriad of businesses, he's also co-authored a variety of books. He's a two-time New York Times best-selling author. He wrote a series of books, The Intellectual Devotional, and he's the author of The Startup Playbook, through which he's interviewed a who's who of today's leading entrepreneurs. It's our pleasure to have David Kidder on the VFA Smart People Should Build Things podcast. David, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Love VFA and the whole crew, so it's a real privilege.
So you're one of the first people we've had who is a true serial entrepreneur. I counted six companies that you've started, if you include your fund. NetX, SmartRay Network, Renaissance Integrated Solutions, Clickable, Alt Option Return, and Bionic Solutions, where you are now. And you've done a ton of research into entrepreneurship as well. There are entrepreneurs, and then there are serial entrepreneurs. From your experience, why are some people one but not the other?
Well, I mean, it's like a career choice, I guess. You know, if you can't really work for anybody, you better learn how to work for yourself. So, you know, some of those of the six, two are actually funds that I are of that we make investments out of in the four our companies. But, you know, I guess a serial entrepreneur is someone who has made building things their career. You know, sometimes you have one and done entrepreneurs. Sometimes you have people who are in a professional environment for a long period of time and end up spinning something out or starting a company. And in my kind of career choices, I just love to build things, and I like to focus on one thing at a time. And so I guess if the average startup takes between 4 and 8 years, if you work for 20 years or 30 years, those numbers sort of add up, I guess. On the every other, the other side of every company either is an exit for good or exit for bad. So our batting average is pretty good, but we've also had the whole journey of, you know, kind of a small, medium, large exits to total soul-crushing failure. So it's the whole experience.
Okay, well, we'll try to go through all of them to the extent we can. Let's reach back. You created a web authoring services company, NetX.
Yep.
Before people even knew what the web was, in 1994, I'm trying to reach back. I'm not sure. I was abroad, and I don't think I even had email. I think I was still writing letters at that point. How did you know to create something in 1994 like that?
So it was good fortune, timing, and luck. So one of the things about writing this book, which I did last, called The Startup Playbook, is when you ask the entrepreneurs, you know, on what on a 0 to 100, like what percentage of your outcome or of your exit value, of all the money you have in the bank, is good timing, fortune, and luck. You know, they typically say around 80%, and so it's true about my own experience. So having graduated from RIT in the mid-90s, I had worked for a startup for 2 or 3 years during college that was a partner of Silicon Graphics, and SGI Boxes, if you're familiar with them, powered things like Pro Engineer and Alias and Wavefront, and so we're in industrial design and involved in the engineering side of this. That heavy end software lived on heavy end boxes, like SGI boxes. And at the dawn of the internet, we needed really powerful servers to run these web-based applications. And so the SGI box had this thing called WebForce. And that was with 94. And we were like, literally, you could go into the internet, which barely existed back then. You could like register any domain name for effectively $2 or $3. It was wide open. And we were working with some large agencies who their clients wanted to be in the web, and they had no way to kind of make these pages. And so we started building both the services and the software to do that. And so that was the beginning. And then we ended up selling that company a couple of years later, 2 years later, and then did a roll up. I joined a team that did a roll up called Think New Ideas that went public. It was backed by Omnicom, and that exited. And then I did a company called SmartRay, which was very early. It was the early mobile web, mobile alert business built on top of TIBCO with Insta, with Reuters and Instanet. Was in the message-to-moment marketing world. So when you're mobile devices, you want to be notified of something. We built that notification infrastructure now 13 years ago. And we ended up selling that after the dot-com crash for a pretty good exit.
So let me jump in there. So so I was curious one thing, and especially considering what you just said, which is that you love building things. So you have your first company, your first exit, and you went and worked for a roll-up.
Yeah.
And you did that for, what, three years or so?
About like three and a half years, yep.
And that must have been a really different feel for you. Were you just bursting at the seams, or were you really happy to be there? Did you learn a ton?
I did. It was I worked directly with one of the founders of that company, and so I think that was where I learned a lot of experience in just how to scale something. You know, we going from like I think 80 to 500 employees in 18 months. It was totally crazy, and that was really the Wild West. I mean, the whole team, the whole culture was just it was nuts and a lot of fun. And I learned a ton of things. And then started up again on the other side of that, and so that was the next company, SmartRay.
And so SmartRay is what you just said. It was rolled into LifeMinders, and then,
they bought it for a little over $40 million. We raised about $5 million in venture. We made no revenue. We had like I think 30 engineers. It was crazy, but the idea was that because mobile devices at the time were these like little crazy WAP devices, which was like a slightly more mature version at the time of those SkyTel pagers, and it was totally ridiculous to do this. And but the key was is that you when you're away from your desktop or your home computer at the time, when you're notified of something, you want it to have a very high threshold of meaning. So you could get alerts based on the data and the news you followed. So it's basically exception-based rule sets. It's only notify me under these conditions. You know, if it's raining and below 50 degrees outside, notify me. Or, you know, my flight's delayed, notify me. What you discover is that, you know, data is not all, you know, not all data is equal. So a flight delay is has a very different economic consequence than a flight cancellation. Flight delay is a cup of coffee. A flight cancellation is a $1,000 event between hotel and travel and returning home or staying local. So, you know, that concept was around building an alerting infrastructure around mobile devices that made the device more valuable. And this is pre-app era.
Right.
This is in 1999 to 2001. We were selling, I think, in 2001.
Sorry, so you were just way ahead of the curve on that one.
It was really early for it? Yes. Yeah. This is the timing and luck part of it. We still had a great exit. I mean, it was good for us. But, you know, to build a whole company was probably not in the cards relative to, you know, the marketplace, as you know, the whole kind of dot-com crash. So I've lived through the dot-com crash in 2008 and all these crazy events while building. So you kind of get used to uncertainty, so to speak.
And so where are we now relative to then? Do you see the same kind of dynamic? Is it different? Are you worried about a bubble? Does it matter to you at all? Is it both as an investor and as someone who's you know got another venture going on right now?
Yeah. So not really, to be honest with you. I think that you know they always say that it takes 20 years for our technology to go to mainstream. We're still effectively building off the back of the dawn of the internet. So we're 20 years into it, right? 95 to 2015. So we're now in a mainstream state. So a lot of the applications and businesses that we're building on are sort of like a mature digital marketplace as opposed to a mature physical marketplace or a mature industrial marketplace. The backbone of what we're doing is not shaky, so to speak, i.e. infrastructure or industrial complex, whatever. We have a digital complex that we're built off of that's creating disruption. And also, you know, this other major element now, which is just mobile. And I mean, you hear the slow, you know, what is it? Slow-mo-low or whatever it is, solo-mo. social, local, mobile. You know, the larger meta theme is that, you know, most product cycles that have existed before, you know, a globally networked world that's always on with a supercomputer and product in your pocket, most of those marketplaces are, you know, ripe for disruption. And that's pretty much almost all industries in some way. Whether you're an industrial company and you're moving to the industrial internet and value is changing to, you know, the Uberization of most businesses, the on-demand gig economy, as we heard last week.
And you already talked about the role of luck in others' experiences.
Yeah.
Are you going to give it the same 70-80%, I think you said, that others give? Do you feel like you've been as lucky, more lucky, less lucky than anyone else?
I don't know. I mean, you have to, if you treat your own professional life like a venture capital fund, your venture capital is your time and money and the value of that. And over your career, you want to be building up the value of your time and money relative to an expertise. But, you know, one of the things I learned from a friend of mine, Reid Hoffman, is that you need to have extreme focus on a single big idea. It's one of the five lenses of the startup playbook, but it's really about getting really, really, really good at one thing. And over your career, a lot of these companies are important to you, but they're experimentations in a lot of ways until they work or don't work. And so, you know, being on the right side of, you know, an outcome can be both one of timing. So you try to get really good at timing, right? You know, you're very early mobile. We had still a good exit, but we were very much on time for the sort of internet software services business. That was an example of that. I have friends who are, you know, at least in the Valley of New York, were all brilliant, all smart, and just had the right company at the wrong time. And then companies I've had friends who have exited around the hype curve, who've had massive exits, who are, you know, were weeks away from going from bankruptcy. So like you have to look at that, and, you know, timing is a really critical skill of when you believe that market maturity is going to happen and how your solution to a customer problem exists at that intersection. So that's an instinct and a skill that needs to be formed in you.
So is that the one, and I apologize, would you say the general rule was?
Have extreme focus on a single big idea or a bigger, you know, I guess you could call it the kind of Gladwellian test, the 10,000 hours that goes into something.
Okay.
Find out what your proprietary gift is and focus on that.
So what is David Kinner's proprietary gift?
A good question. You know, I'm not that smart, and I'm not that, I have found that I'm very good at framing things, so going into very complex situations and framing them, and being able to sort of understand signal to noise, so to speak. And then secondly is just building roadmaps that get to commercial truth, you know, and really fighting for the kind of intellectual honesty about what customers really care about and do versus what you hope to be true. So on a spectrum of being like an irrational pessimist and a pathological optimist. Early in your career, you kind of start in the pathological optimism bucket, which is like, if I believe, it'll be true. And as you go through and you get sort of knocked down a couple times, you start becoming more of a rational thinker. And that's a good place to stop. You don't want to get to like irrational pessimism, and some people will begin there and become rationalists, but somewhere between optimists and rational optimists is a really good place to start thinking about how to build businesses. And as Elon often says, wishful thinking is the enemy, and kind of work that out of your psyche.
Don't you kind of need to be a little bit irrational, considering how many businesses fail, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know what the actual numbers are. You know, people always throw out those stats of the number of startups that fail, and who knows what's actually accurate. But considering the number that failed, don't you kind of have to be a little bit irrational about your idea?
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you're going in totally rationally, you kind of say, well, the odds are kind of against
me. I mean, you can be irrational and optimistic, but evidence-based.
Right.
So I think what matters is that you're the core assumptions that you're building business on are actually true. There's commercial truth in that, and you're driving commercial truth. So you may be optimistic or irrational on the way to that intersection 2 or 3 years down the road, you know, when that the role changes and you've won. That might be the optimism, the irrational part of how fast that will happen. But the rational part is actually building up the logic around what customers do versus what they say that leads to that truth. So that's a part of it. And that's sort of a skill and an experience thing that teaches you. You know, there was a statistic I saw, like, I don't know, a couple of years ago that said, you know, what's the average age of a successful exit from a venture capitalist? And, you know, you hear these stories of, you know, this the ton of 20-something wunderkind, the Mark Zuckerbergs and others who are the phenoms. And that does happen, but they are truly unicorns. I mean, I think the average age was the average in venture investment was around a three-time entrepreneur in their mid-30s who exited in their 40s. So it really is a skill. And some people are born with it, and some people have to have the instinct, but they had to develop it. I'm probably more towards that.
Right. Okay. Well, there's still hope for me. I'm at the tender age of 39, so I'm good. Busting into my good. 40s.
And, that's good. No, I mean, you've already won humanity's lottery. You're not going to go hungry, and you're not right. going to like run clean water. So, you know, you can always go and build.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 12 years one business, and so that's right. one of the reasons why I asked that about that at the beginning. The difference between serial entrepreneurs, and
well, you're a classic overnight success then, right? Yeah. Because it takes 8 to 10 years to figure it out. Yeah.
I appreciate that. So let me ask you about that the transitioning again, because looking at your bio, you took some time off after SmartRay?
Yes.
What did you do with that time, and how did you know it was time to jump back in? Considering you're a serial entrepreneur and you see so many, I'm sure there are ideas constantly cycling through that you're considering. When do you know, one's the that's the,
right.
I'm trying to think of a good metaphor, that's the one you want to marry.
So after SmartRay, I just kind of, I hit the road. I had my kind of like Big Lebowski 2 years and traveled to a couple dozen countries, started in Tibet and, all over China and Africa and India and
solo.
All over. Yeah. And it was really an amazing experience. I mean, I've seen everything from, I guess my backpack had the top half was like all my sort of like traveling gear where you get in a Jeep and go 3 weeks into a safari and you don't see anyone. And the bottom half was like Prada. So I had like, my assistant was, planning, an amazing adventures where you get lost in the world, and then I'd like go stay at some of the best hotels in the world at the, and hang out for a week or two. So it was a really great adventure, and it took much longer than I expected. But I was, after about 9 months to 12 of the 2 years that I was sort of like hanging around, I started getting really itchy. So just to start something. And so that's actually a super bad instinct, as it turns out. You really, if you think of the number of business plans an entrepreneur would write in their lifetime, it's in the dozens typically. It's just really discovering what they care about the most, and so it's following that effort. But what's interesting is I don't think I learned the sort of selection lenses around ideas up until probably 5 years ago, when in my last company, which we were crossing the chasm on very painfully, we'd raised a ton of venture capital. I kept thinking to myself, like, how did I miss this? Like, I had made one or two pretty catastrophic strategic mistakes, and you think by then you kind of know what you're doing,
right?
And then you get really tested. And I'll tell you about a little bit the kind of psychology around that experience. But also,
this is at Clickable now.
This is Clickable, okay. And I went out and started just, asking some of my mentors and things that I've invested in, the CEOs and their mentors. Basically two questions. One is, how do you pick your biggest ideas? Or another way to say that is, before you bet your life on something, what qualities does it have to have? What criteria does it have to pass? And then secondly is, what do you do in the first 5 years not to die? And that became, because I realized I needed that information, because as a VC, an investor, you get to see, 50 movies. If you're an entrepreneur, you're like, you're doing one movie at a time. So it's just vantage. It's mm-hmm. perspective advantage. It's the story you get to understand, and you need that to cheat time. And so I went and basically cheated time, and the answer came back to that was quite profound.
And that's what became Renaissance? Is it when you were...
That became the Startup Playbook.
Startup Playbook. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm advancing a little further here.
That's fine.
Because I had this...
You can create your narrative as you go. No, it's no worries.
So you're asking about like the selection stuff or what I learned on that trip. And I think...
That led you to research this.
Yeah, I mean, it was a personal journey. Just
got it.
Discovery. And so over those years, I started focusing on things that I cared about more than anyone else. And so I started writing a book series with a friend of mine now who runs the Today Show, Noah Oppenheim, which became the Intellectual Devotion.
Right.
And that
five books, and two of which were New York Times bestsellers.
Yeah, that was crazy. And it was like this cathartic, like I wrote and illustrated my basement for a year and created every part of the book, because it was something like, I want this. I would buy this product. And so I sort of like stopped listening to like white space and just started chasing things that I cared about. It turns out that like that was some of the most successful stuff I've ever done. It was a really powerful lesson. And I didn't understand why until 6 years later when I wrote the Startup Playbook, which is the number one lens of all the entrepreneurs, the number one lens was the idea of proprietary giftedness. Is that when you create something, a company, you have to have an obsession and an advantage at a skill level that no one else in the world has. Or if you dedicate your life into something for several years, you would probably have a good chance of being the top three people in the world to do it. Turns out this book and my last company are both examples of like, there's might be three people in the world that could create this if they cared as much and had my skill to do it. And that book series is an example of that. And Bionic is an example of that now. So the proprietary giftedness lens or criteria is the number one idea, the number one lens to think about before you start a company. If you're chasing white space or opportunity, the one who wins that space is likely to have passed the proprietary giftedness, is going to kick your butt because they're born to do it. And mm-hmm. you have to have that level of passion and care about an idea or a problem to solve it.
Give us a couple. I mean, I'm sure they're well-known entrepreneurs who have this proprietary yeah. giftedness
Well, we see them. I mean, we see people who innately understand the social economy, you know, the Reeds of the world, the Marx of the world, the obvious ones. Understand through life experiences, the Dorsey around, you know, understanding cities and Twitter.
So to simplify, I mean, is this why we're not using Friendster right now, but we're
Maybe.
Using Facebook? Because
yeah.
Mark
so,
Zuckerberg had this proprietary giftedness and this complete insane passion for this?
Very likely. When you're investing in it, I mean, Peter Thiel, who was my biggest investor in my last company through the Founders Fund, I mean, they looked at a lot of social media companies, a lot. Mm-hmm. So when they knew that was a movement, and if you sort of look at the PayPal mafia around social, you know, it's, you know, Peter to Mark, Reed at LinkedIn, to some extent, Max and the whole slide is there's a social gaming element to that, to Zynga, to Yammer. I mean, with David Sachs, like that origin of that idea was who has the proprietary gift enough to take this idea and then express it
right.
in these marketplaces, and so that's an example of a proprietary giftedness. So, but I think you have to sort of examine that yourself, you know. You know, you have to really have a very good, truthful conversation with yourself on, like, what is my proprietary gift? And the second conversation is how do I quit all my weaknesses? I don't, you know, at some point you need to end fixing yourself so you can get the concentration of energy and mindshare into that one thing, because in extreme focus, that's where the understanding and the development happens that no one else can do, because optionality is your enemy.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories.
Okay, so you made me curious. Where is the pardon me, where's the spot where you deviated from your proprietary giftedness and went a little bit astray?
Yeah. So, I mean, my company, Clickable, was more of a white space opportunity. You know, you had a huge marketplace like search. It was a very complex tool system to use. And it's funny, when I started the company, I raised like $22 million like in 1 year. I went zero to big very fast in terms of capital. I had like, I don't know, $20 million in the bank and 15 employees at the time, pre-revenue. But I had 3,000 customers almost out of the box who were willing to buy this thing. So we had a very strong buying signal. But what we didn't understand is that they're actually, what they wanted was a painkiller. And the painkiller, what we had built was a thing we patented called the ACT engine, an actionable recommendation engine. We'll look at all your data and then tell you the answers. So, but because I didn't really know what the proprietary gift of the company was, because I didn't understand that yet in my own sort of maturity as an entrepreneur, I started to sort of like fall into the trap of like suffering from the sin of comparison. Like, what are the other players doing out there? How do I create a position that sort of like rides over top of everyone else? I started chasing on people's press releases, or trying to win the sort of press war, the air war for the company, as opposed to generate, you know, growth, as opposed to like just building the product.
This is against your better judgment. Do you know you're making this mistake as you're doing it, or is it just kind of like
everything's
moving so quickly that you got to do it, and you're not really thinking?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on you
right.
to create growth,
right.
and. I don't know. I think looking back, we had the answer very early, and we just lost focus.
But you still had an exit, right? You still
yeah. We were selling the company, but we so on our way doing that, we, I don't think I've ever publicly talked about this. We raised a bunch of money, grew the company to about 125 employees, 150 employees over a period of like 3 years, and we're in revenue and growing. And then we ended up doing a very big strategic investment from a big bank, which is public, it's Amex. Mm. And what we realized at the time was they had a tremendous amount of Google advertising spend on credit cards. And so it made a lot of sense, since we were in the digital marketing business, to go where the money was actually collected, because you could connect transactional data with spend. Mm. That's sort of the holy grail, if you know anything about ad tech. And so that was the goal of it. But by the time we actually took the money and launched the product, which took a very long time, because we're moving fast and independent. And it's sort of like giving one wheel of your Ferrari to another company. Like, you sort of spin out. Like, you can go fast, but like, even if you lose control of one wheel, it's very difficult to like recover from that. And I think that I just didn't understand that. And I think I realized at some point after a year of taking that investment that I was building two companies at once. Hmm. And you know, you can love your like Siamese twin head kid, but like,
I would hope so.
No one else really wants to buy your Siamese twin kid head. So, and when you tear a Siamese twin in half, like, it dies. So like, you know, these are bad outcomes, and you don't realize you're doing it, but it's all exciting and high growth to turn back. You're like, how did I miss that? Which is why I wrote the book, so to kind of discover that idea.
Right.
But that's sort of how it came. So we ended up selling a piece back to them. Their kind of Siamese twin head, and
right.
We took the rest, and we merged with another company, and then I ended up leaving. And then about a year later, that company like had a number of exit opportunities, but we were on the other side of sort of the hype curve at that point, and the company ended up not making it over that next curve.
That company failed.
Yes.
Syncaps,
yep, a year later,
the company that you sold to.
Yep.
Is that a heartbreaker? I mean, are you emotionally, once you're gone, are you emotionally gone? How did it feel to see them fold up?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because a lot of people...
Were all your people still there?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I didn't really realize this, but I've always promised my team members that we will cross the finish line. So you can validate this. So if any of my former Clickable partners and friends are listening, they'll tell you, like, we would always... This was the promise, which is, I will do whatever it takes to cross the finish line. You will get a W. You may not make money, you may make a fortune, but we will cross the finish line. So I sort of feel okay about finishing that. But the truth is, it never feels good. You know, the whole reason why we do this is to create growth for our investors. And I love our investors. They're some of my close friends, and I deeply respect them. This is the Fred Wilsons and Albert Wengers and Rick Heitzman's at First Mark and Brian Singerman and Peter Thiel and Ken. And we all have a good relationship, but we also recognize that we're all betting our lives on things. We're kind of in the Powerball, you know, game, so to speak. But you never want to go through the experience. But I'll tell you, what I learned out of that is a couple very critical sort of like psychological lessons that unless you go through it, that test, you wouldn't really understand, I don't think, what it means to be an entrepreneur with sort of freedom. Okay, so the first one is that you are more than your company, and until you realize that, until you separate yourself from your company, that you are more than your company, you are more than your kid, you are more than your marriage, like those sort of things, you really are not in a position to make the right objective decisions about what's good for it, because it becomes so close to you, it becomes you. And then your identity is the company, and then you're worried about the harm of your identity than the harm of the company. So that one psychological hurdle is very, very critical. And the second one I learned out of that was, put another way is, if my company fails, while that's a failure in my life experience, it doesn't mean you are a failure. It means this lesson, you know, success is a bad educator. This is going to be a painful lesson, but you can lift yourself out of those thorns,
right,
and restart, which I've done, and it's a very important thing for life, I think. The second one is that you actually are not in control. So whatever your spiritual origin, whether you believe in the universe or God or whatever it is, like, you know, you have to turn over these big bets, you know, over to a power that you recognize you don't control, and so you can kill yourself. And you can leave everything in the field, and things can still fail. And likewise, you can also kill yourself, and that can be hugely successful. But those outcomes, ultimately, in my this is again my view of the world, aren't in your control, because you really can't control. We had two exit opportunities for large numbers in my last company, at Clickable, and we just couldn't get there. You know, it was a head of M&A who woke up on the wrong side of the bed and blew up a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-IPO company, big social company, couldn't get a deal done. You know, if it did happen, we would have been heroes and geniuses. But we're the same people, even though
right.
the deal didn't happen, right? And it was still in the same company. And I have friends who got those deals done and made fortunes who are, you know, they're successful. I'm very grateful for them and proud of them, but same type of outcome. But what I learned is that the more you fear because you believe you can control the elements, the more you squeeze it, the fewer options you have, because you're actually considering fewer options. So, and another way to say this is to be decisive for your company, you have to back up and consider all of the options for it, mm-hmm. including outright failure. Mm-hmm. That is actually a very real option.
Right.
That it goes, blows up, and you are reputation harm. That is an option, right? Or you have to kill it. As well, there are options that we don't control. So I was brought to my knees in that company because I lost like 17 pounds in like 90 days trying to get it across the finish line. And at the end, I just had nothing left. And I have a very good network. I just couldn't get a deal done. And out of the blue, quote unquote, after going through this experience, the knock at the door came, and we ended up, you know, getting an exit that had nothing to do with me.
Right.
Because that option wasn't one of my options. Do I make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's a very, these are the, you are more than your company, and you have to consider all the options, of which to consider them all, you have to like let the company go, to let it become what it's supposed to become. While they seem subtle, they're actually incredibly profound because they eliminate fear to actually lead.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
What I'm fascinated by is your discussion of failure in such personal terms and the separation of yourself from failure. And I worry that we've gone dangerously to the other side where failure is almost glorified, you know, this fail fast
or
type
thing. Let failure go to your head, right?
Yeah. You
right.
know, and I mean, are you is that where you at all? You worry you're getting entrepreneurs that you're invested in that are gonna take some money, fail, and walk away and say, you know, maybe not feel that desperation and say like, yeah,
right.
you know, I've got to.
No, I had desperation.
Make this thing work. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I think, let's put it this way. I think this is very important to characterize failure. There is productive failure, which is, I'm very comfortable with, which is cheap failure. And then there's like failure, expensive failure, which is catastrophic, which is your company dies, you spend all your money, you know, unwisely, those sort of things. Like,
right.
there's an institutional failure
right.
level you should be very, very uncomfortable
right.
with. And there's a productive failure, which is, you should be okay with that. And so that productive failure is about the experimentation, the first principles of logic. You've read this. Eric Ries is a good buddy of mine. Just the whole concept of lean and mm-hmm. experimentation, which allows the evidence to appear based on what customers do versus what they say, as opposed to like your addiction to being right or your mm-hmm. personal, you know, will to take, you know, take in a marketplace. Very rarely does that work. So this, in this context, that's an important skill. But catastrophic failure is something that you should reflect on a lot as you build up
right.
these learnings, because you want to avoid it.
Yeah. So during this time, you're building Clickable, you're going at it, you're raising mm-hmm. funds,
yep.
you're developing your product, you're losing, you know, sleep and weight potentially.
Well, I had six books go, six years, I had six books.
That's what I wanted to ask.
I had three kids.
Where?
And a startup.
So where is the time to write these six books coming from?
Yeah.
Where is the, where's the time to spend with three kids?
It's very important to, so a friend of mine, a guy named Richard St. John, who I've gone to TED for the last, I guess almost 11, 12 years now, and he's a wonderful writer and interviewer and incredibly curious, wonderful guy. And he wrote this book about the myth of work-life balance. And he basically said, you have to choose your family or your work. So he talked to hundreds of CEOs and founders and executives and realized that there is no such thing as work-life balance. It's a myth. There's only one way to solve for it, which is you have to pick your family or you pick your work. Or you can give up sleep.
Okay.
That's
so
the only.
So how many hours a day are you sleeping?
Right? I mean, now I'm probably like six, seven, but back during those years, I was probably five, maybe. It was really bad.
Right.
But I, you know, you just have the burning drive, and that was just a chapter. I went from 34 to, I'm 42, so maybe 32 to 40, where I just didn't need it, maybe.
Right.
Maybe I'll die of a heart attack in a couple of years, who knows? But like, that was a chapter where that was just what was required, and I also have great people around me.
Right.
I mean, I've had the same executive assistant who's incredibly talented for the last 8 years, Susan Green. I have a personal controller who manages all my finances, so I don't spend even a second thinking about money, which is not a good or a bad thing. So whether you have a little or a lot, it doesn't matter. It's just that's a low return on my mindset. My cycles, like you could have someone do that for you. So if I'm building my company where my real wealth is coming from, I don't need to manage the pieces that take up cycles of learning, like your insurance or whatever those things are. That can be done for you. I had great collaborators in writing books. So I've always had a partner. So while the yield is high, I have good agents and I have good co-authors and I have good editors. Like it can scale based on the time. You just have to be incredibly efficient. And that's one of the things I'm very good at is I have an incredibly tight system of how I manage every moment of my day towards the highest priorities, and have developed that over the last 10 years.
Neil Cable was on the show a few weeks ago from Sail Through.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, by the way.
He's
what
hilarious.
An awesome company.
Yeah, hilarious guy.
Those guys are killing it. I love that idea.
Listen to that podcast. He told a chilling story towards the end.
I will.
I'm going to use it as a teaser here to get people to listen to that episode. He talked about work-life integration, which I thought was interesting. He doesn't believe in work-life balance either.
Yeah, I
don't. He sort of believes that we didn't get too into it, but he was I think what I've come to believe, that I am, to me, the most valuable thing as an entrepreneur is not money, but flexibility and freedom.
Yeah,
and
time is the new money, for sure, without a doubt.
So, like, you know, I can...
Or it appear to be relaxing when you're really working, right? You're on a beach, but you're, like, working, you know, like
I was doing that 2 days ago.
Yeah, exactly. You're all tan, dude.
Yeah, so that's something that I believe in.
Yeah.
I managed to knock out 2 books as well, though not quite on the... not bestsellers.
But that's, again, good timing, fortune. But the other thought about... this is, like, I think another way to simplify it to say is that you have to bring the same love for your family and your kids you have to bring for your work. But what you have to be very careful with, and this is something I need to be very careful, is that I have to bring the same love to my family I do to my work, vice versa, my work to my family, because, you know, you really do have this fidelity around your company, and it's a really bad, could be a really bad relationship or an addiction. Like, you have to be, like, very careful that I am bringing that symmetry, that integration, that integrated life to both my work and my family's, to my work, and making sure that I'm not cheating either one.
So let me ask you this. When did you, at what point in your entrepreneurial biography or your entrepreneurial history did you start a family? Like, was there a time, could you have had a family when you started? And, you know, I don't know how old you were. I guess you were right out of college when you started your first venture, so maybe that was a little early. But, you know, Smart Ray, could you have had a family at that point? Or
I don't know. So, yes, I think you can. I mean, one thing about a family, you have kids, but...
I do, I have one.
Right, so I have 3 little boys, they're crazy. But it's like it brings an incredible filter to your time.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You know this.
Amazing,
like, because when you're in your 20s and your early 30s, you can spend all day in the office, and, you know, maybe 20% of that time is wasted. When you're taking 20% of your time, like, that's time of my sons. Like, that's incredibly expensive time. So... I mean, even before I got to this interview, I had 2 back-to-back meetings that, like, within 30 minutes of the hours I'm in, I'm like, okay, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I didn't want to be rude, but I had people around me who could lead the meeting for it, but my contribution was going to zero, and I can't burn that time.
Right.
So, like, that's an example of, like, I'm collecting those hours, that time back in the day, and maximizing how you commute. In fact, I've just read some interesting articles about, it's called, I don't know if it's called, like, collective triggering or something, which is if you want to achieve a goal, you collect it and trigger around something you dislike to do. So you would actually listen to whatever, a financial modeling book while you worked out, or you listen, you know, watch movies, things like that. Like, and it's just about really condensing the value of your time.
Right. Interesting. So let's talk about Bionic.
Yep.
So you've learned from Clickable.
Yep.
And Clickable still exists.
Yeah, ironically,
in some form, right?
So this is the amusing part about it, is that I guess there's nothing amusing about it. One is I love that company, not a little. Like, I mean, the people and the culture and the brand and what it meant for. But it was a very tough lesson. But I you know, even today, I mean, it still has a fantastic reputation. The people around it, what we meant at the marketplace, but it just was short-lived. But the company that bought it now, actually, that is their brand. So, like, I will be, because of geo-targeted, retargeted ad tech, and because I still look for it, I'm being served ads for, like, Clickable. It's like, you're seeing, like, this, you know, that long lost love, and it's like, it's just so weird, because it's you in that idea, and it's not you.
That's hilarious.
It's like a ghost.
Okay, so let's talk about Bionic.
Yes.
So how, and I'm curious about one other thing, actually.
Yeah.
I'm trying
to
get to these, but it seems like you're always co-founding, and why
is that?
Why co-found? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you're kind of already touched upon, you know, playing to your strengths and efficiencies, mm-hmm. in letting other people pick up where maybe you're a little weaker,
it's
less important to you.
Yeah.
I'll let you go out and grab some water here. This is it'll add to the character of the show. We'll hear you wrestling with the plastic
cards. Okay.
Why co-founders? And then just force me to go right to Bionic, because I know you're on a tight time schedule.
Yeah, sure. So why a co-founder? So this is a actual real statistic, is that if you took a working horse, a Clydesdale or some large horse, I don't know much about horses, but I know the statistics behind it, which is one horse can pull 2,600 pounds. Two collectively yoked can pull 28,000. So, like, it's literally an order of magnitude of force.
Interesting.
And so, if you have a really good co-founder and you're strong in those in opposite but equally compounding skills, the pace and speed of the company just grow literally an order of magnitude. So, you just get more done. You have higher quality thinking. You can lead in different ways. You can see weaknesses and strengths. You can go on. I mean, my co-founder now is the best co-founder I've ever had in my life. Her name is Anne Berkowitz. You should interview her. She's the real star.
Fantastic. Bring her on.
She's the founder of Select Minds. She sold to Oracle for about 3.5 years ago. Tried to semi-retire, and I wouldn't let her do it. She's now my co-founder. And, you know, has a beautiful mind, MIT polymath type of person. And she's an amazing operator. You know, she runs the company, which, you know, for me, I can do but don't enjoy doing. I'd rather my time, you know, doing the job of a founder and CEO, which is basically three things. It's vision, it's talent, and it's never run out of money. Mm-hmm. That's the job, you know, and she is my perfect complement in building this thing. And we're very fortunate, and we're growing really fast, and we're self-funded. We're about almost 20 people now. We'll be 18 to 20 people by the end of Q3. And we'll do about $10 million revenue this year, so it's gone pretty quickly.
Fascinating that you're self-funding. How did you make that choice, considering you have a history of raising
funds? Yeah, I've raised a lot of money. I just because we can. We have we have very big customers who have tremendous, you know, the best validation in the world is get paid for something. So right. we're going in and solving a very, very big problem, and that is that big companies struggle to get to commercial truth. There's so much internal bias towards decision making that I don't mean this in a negative way. It just is it's sort of what exists in big companies. There's an intellectual dishonesty around decisions that this decision matters more for internal reasons than external reasons. Okay. It matters more about the internal politics and decision making than does actually what the customer wants to buy.
Right.
So we built this growth operating system, we call this, that, and we've been pretty secretive about this. I'm not talking publicly about it because we're growing very quickly.
Okay.
We work directly for the CEO, and we help create a framework for them to make a very, very large volume of bets with their teams in particular market areas where there's a lot of growth. This could be Bitcoin or drones or, you know, athleticism, whatever it is, you know, for our customers. And they use our team and our tools. We have a platform called validate.com, which you can't see, but it exists. We own the verb and the trademark. That's becoming code for commercial truth. Did you validate that? Did you validate that? Did you validate that? And we have a tool set with, you know, tools and experts and customers that can exist in a single place. So if you're the CEO and you're buying a decision, you can believe the decision as opposed to crossing your fingers that you hope your team is right. And this is a massive, massive problem we're going after, and we're really, you know, growing into it very quickly.
It's almost fortuitous that you can't discuss it because I know we don't have that much time.
I know. There you go. So, I know. I completely hosed you today because of the
That's okay. Yeah. Do you have a few?
Yeah,
few
I do.
More?
Okay, I'll go right up to the edge. I can go right up to and I'll jump on a call.
So I'm curious. So I mean, a couple of things here. So you're self-funding this, and you're also making investments through all the option return. Do you have a different framework that you use for things that you're investing your money in versus things you're investing your time in?
Yeah.
How do you make those choices?
So, no. In fact, the time value of my money is much, 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 much higher than the actual cash investments. I mean, we're doing, our range can go from $25,000 to $100,000. We're classic seed stage investors. We've done about 30 plus deals that range from contently and artsy and tap ad to, you know, we're also investors and limited partners in the Founders Fund. So we're in Airbnb and Palantir and SpaceX and other things. They're pretty cool. But I do, you know, we do, you know, several investments a year and sometimes 7 months a quarter through both of those vehicles. But, interesting to your point, I use the five lenses out of the startup playbook in both scenarios, both for my professional career, for what we do, and for my investments. And those five lenses, as I gave the first one, is there is not a credible answer to these questions, either out of the box, investment opportunity, or over a short period of time, call it 1 to 3 years, it's probably not a good investment in my view, because this is the lenses on the minds of some of the best entrepreneurs in the world, from Sarah Blakely to Reed, Elon, and others. And then that first one is proprietary giftedness. Does the founder have a proprietary gift? That's true. What's the unfair advantage at a skill level? What do they know that no one else in the world knows? Life experience, skill, knowledge, mm-hmm. whatever that is, a secret. Number two is, how have they gained extreme focus on a single big idea? You know, you want to invest in, you know, as Michael Moritz once told me, he said, you want to invest in, you know, farms, like horse farms or sheep farms or cow farms. Mm-hmm. You don't want to invest in farms with short, you know, sheep and cows and ducks running around together, like extreme focus, right? He did that while his feet were on a table and I was staring at his feet. The third one is to build painkillers and not vitamins. You've probably heard of that because of, you know, your right. venture capital days. It got to be dealing with chronic, lifelong, malignant, growing pain.
Right.
Vitamins are elective. Those are hopeful. Wouldn't it be great if that happened? You know, just ask that customer to change the behavior. Very unlikely.
Right.
The third reason is harder because it's almost like a funnel. If it does, there's no proprietary gift. If there's extreme focus on a single big idea, if it's a painkiller, now you're in the execution phases. And so now the fourth lens is there a credible roadmap over a period of time, call it 3 years, that they can actually create something that's 10 times better? You've heard us in the past, 10x. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the point is, like, if you get trapped between something that's probably incrementally better, 2 or 3 times better, but it's perishable, competitive landscapes are, you know, the competitors are not dumb. They're going to figure it out. And it's that advantage will expire. So you want to find something that's permanent. And another way to think about that is 97% of all, you know, investments, including, you know, my own experience at Clickable, go to asset sales, right? So that mm-hmm. one asset better be should be able to stamp the whole value of the company in a lot of cases, as opposed to be evenly distributed across all the assets.
Right.
Very big idea. The last one is, this sort of surprised me, but about how aggressive you need to be, is you need to be a monopolist from day one. Hmm. Creating permanence in the life of the customer, the problem. You know, hooks and barbs intentionally. And so there can be a lot of goodwill behind that, but you want to be in a place where you have permanence. Those four lenses guide my investment thesis and what I'm building at Bionic.
I want to ask you this.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I get this in. We got 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
You, for whatever reason, you know, have to walk away from your company. Your co-founder has to walk away from your company.
Yep.
You've talked about some, you know, big time CEOs here. You know, founders Elon Musk and Reid Hoffman and, you know, Steve Case. You've interviewed and Sarah Blakely
yep.
and all these amazing people. Who are you picking to run your company and why? And or even someone you haven't interviewed. I mean, or someone you haven't mentioned, of course.
Yeah.
But, isn't that profile? Is
yeah.
what I'm saying.
I mean, in the book, by the way, I always jokingly say that, like, I have the good fortune of knowing a bunch of, like, the Brad Pitts of the startup world, and I'm sort of like a Steve Buscemi, like, I'm a career actor. But and a lot in the book as well, there's a lot of fantastically, hugely successful career actors. You know, they built companies,
right.
and they had great exits, and, you know, maybe they're not a billionaire, but they have a tremendous amount of liquidity. They've done very well, but they're back at work building things. They're builders. That's sort of the job. That's what I do. I would want to hand, like, our company will be acquired at some point in the next, I want to do it for 10 years. I'm 2 years into that. So my intention is to get across the finish line. This is the whole promise. And so I think I'd want to turn it over to the hands of another entrepreneur. So, like, I don't know who the natural owner is of the company. I'm not even thinking about that. I'm not thinking about exit or, like, I can tell you that honestly, I've probably only spent maybe a half hour in 2.5-3 years, even look at the competitive landscape.
Hmm.
I do not care. I'm building my one thing, that problem, and my obsession with that problem is all that matters. And if it fails for that, then I failed. But if it doesn't, then I need every ounce of that energy to be not listening to the noise, but listening to that problem. So I would hope that we would exit to someone who cares about and values that problem as much as we do, and is ideally built and owned and still run by an entrepreneur. And that remains to be seen. I don't know who that is. But I'm sure we'll discover it in the next couple of years.
Awesome. Thanks so much. I mean, I'm going to let you go. This is a great energy.
Yeah.
I think we managed to compress because we're both talking quickly.
Yeah, I talked very
fast.
A full
interview, and it's great. And then 40 minutes. So
I've tried
so
to fix that, and it doesn't work. My mom has been telling me I talk fast and mumble since I was, like, you know, whatever, a zygote. And I just can't. It's unfixable.
My family just tells me I mumble. So
yeah, I do too.
So
there's
no talk fast.
It's
say,
clearly
you're
not harming you, right? Like, you're hugely successful. Like, what? Okay, mumble. Okay, great. That's a weakness. Who cares? Like, don't fix yourself. So anyways.
Again, I'll let you run to your call, but thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.